Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
On News Talk.
Pat Kenny Show with Anton in for Pat. To look back at the big stories of the week, I'm joined by Jared Howland, public affairs consultant, Irish Examiner columnist and former senior political advisor Nessa Harrigan, Green TD for Dublin Central, and the party spokesperson on finance and health, and Ivana Bacik, Labour Party leader and TD for Dublin Bay South. And of course, where we have to start is with the big political story effectively of this summer. We had the Zappone story the year before. We had Golfgate the year before. This summer is Robert Troy. One of the interesting things about it, Jared, was the expenditure of political capital by the Taoiseach and Tánaiste and party colleagues of Robert Troy in defending him right up to the moment of his own resignation.
It wasn't an enormous expenditure of capital by many of his colleagues, actually. I counted on one hand, I think, that those who stepped forward. There was conspicuous political capital on the part of the Taoiseach, but I wonder, is the narrative being miswritten slightly? So if you do a Sherlock Holmes interrogation of the timeline, Watson, the first one out was the Tánaiste, Robert Troy's senior minister at the Department of Enterprise, and he fulsomely supported Robert Troy. Then, subsequently, in light of that, or at least afterwards, the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, fulsomely supported Robert Troy and stayed in that position until the end, until he resigned. What I don't know is if Micheál Martin would have adopted his previously very swift, clinical, practical orientation of dispatch to Robert Troy if the Tánaiste had not been out.
Although
first.
The last time he wielded the knife so rapidly, it was to Barry Cowan and Dara Kaliri, and the subsequent legal cases in respect of that raised questions about whether he had overdone it. Do you think he has regrets about his response to Golfgate?
There is, in a way, any minister who has not been corrupt is overdone by being fired. That's not to say they shouldn't be fired or shouldn't have to resign. And Robert Troy obviously resigned. He was not fired. Important distinction. But if you look back at Alan Shatter, for one, if you look back at the then Minister for Justice Fitzgerald, you know, in hindsight, they were vindicated. But in politics, either you're an asset or you're a liability. It's a brutal judgment. There's no point in taking it up with the HR department the next day or asking to see your union rep. That's how it works, and there's no comeback and there's no compensation.
And ultimately, what might have been the last nail in the coffin came from your party leader, Nessa Harrigan. It was Eamon Ryan who indicated that the tide had gone out on Robert Troy.
Well, I think what he said was that it was the consistent revelations of more and more information around this was really disappointing, and that it would damage public trust. And I believe Eamon said that, you know, we should have SIPO investigating this, and also the Oireachtas should investigate this. And I think that's exactly right, that's what should be done. And whether Deputy Troy felt at that stage, you know, his position was untenable, I can't say, but I certainly think that is the right course of events to take. And as you say yourself, there have been moments where stories have broken and maybe we have gotten it wrong. But I do think there is an issue here of, you know, there's a difference between a kind of a legal transgression and a kind of a breach of faith with the public and the public perception of that. And it is probably right to step back at that point and allow the proper processes to run. I'm not sure you can, you know, serve as a minister during that time. So, you know, I think Minister Ryan said the exact right thing, to be honest.
Why did it take so long to get there?
Well, if you recall, and I don't want to do the Sherlock Holmes that my colleague has just done, but, you know, it was one revelation after another. And we have seen that play out with other politicians in the past. So I think there was a little bit of everybody waiting and watching and waiting for the next revelation. Are we at the end of this now? And I'm not sure we are even at this stage, but we shall wait and see. And I suspect that's why people were kind of holding their fire for a moment.
It has led to two things. Obviously, there were the questions asked about Robert Troy and his decision to speak on matters pertaining to how landlords were paid when he was a significant landlord and that wasn't recognised. But it has created a subsequent discussion about the disproportionate amount of TDs who are landlords. Between the TDs and senators, we're talking 79 odd out of the joint parliament. Is it difficult for a legislature to have that many people who are landlords and to still legislate for the vast majority of people who are tenants of Anabatch?
Well, Anton, certainly I think people are alarmed to see disproportionate numbers of Oireachtas members who are landlords relative to the population. I should say I think the figure is slightly less than that. That's the number who are landowners, but not necessarily landlords. I think it's 48 who are landlords. It's a minority, but clearly it's still a bigger proportion of the population of TDs and senators than of the normal population. I think at a time when we are seeing a housing crisis, when so many people in my own constituency in Dublin Bay South and across the country are simply unable to get accommodation. I've just heard today from one constituent who's been evicted as her young child starts back to school, has nowhere to go. So, you know, this is a huge issue, and clearly there's huge concern about over-representation of landowners among TDs and senators. Now, I've always called for a more representative of Oireachtas. You know, the fact that less than a quarter of our TDs are women itself speaks volumes about the need for a more diverse representation. We certainly should have more young people, more people of ethnic minority backgrounds, and more renters represented in the Dáil and Shannon.
Attribute the fact that we have so many landlords? Is there any good logical explanation for why?
Well, I think that I should say also, I suppose, Anton, an important point is that the Robert Troy affair is not specifically about property ownership, because, you know, we don't want to dissuade people from running for election, you know, and it's clearly anyone's entitlement to, and right to run for election. We need, as I say, a more representative parliamentary membership. The issue here in the Troy case and the reason for his resignation was a failure to comply with ethical standards that we had put in place precisely to guard against corruption. And Labour has a strong and proud track record of really building and developing our ethical framework. So this was about breaches of ethics, not about property ownership per se. And I know, as you say, the debate has somewhat moved on, particularly because of the housing crisis. But I think, you know, that is an important point to make all the same, that it's about that. Why is it so disproportionate? I think the reality is that, you know, it's difficult to enter politics. It's difficult to sustain a career in politics. It's difficult, as anyone who's ever dipped a toe in the waters of political life will know. It is difficult. We need to ensure there are supports available to younger people, to women, to those who are underrepresented to come into politics. But it is hard. And that's why, I suppose, traditionally, there has been, not just in Ireland, but elsewhere, an overrepresentation of those with property, because they can afford to take the time out to build a political career. That's something we need to change, you know.
Can I ask?
But as I say, it's not really the direct issue that was.
Well,
that
to
was
go back to the direct
Robert
issue,
Troy
one case. Of the interesting things about Robert Troy's quite long resignation letter was the amount of blame that he laid at the feet of other people. He blamed those who vilified landlords, he blamed the opposition, and he blamed the media. Do you feel any sympathy for him in that context? Do you think he was hard done by?
I think there was an element of lashing out in that response, and I think it's unfortunate. I think the reality is that this was a story and I suppose a series of allegations that had built, as Nessa and Gerard have pointed out, it had built over a number of weeks. What was disclosed was not one or two inadvertent oversights, which might have been excusable, but rather a catalogue of omissions, of failures to declare, of careless disregard for those critical ethical rules, as I've said, that we introduced over many years to guard against corruption. And, you know, so it's that sort of carelessness that I think built into the case against him. And I think also there was a very serious misinterpretation by him of a very basic ethical rule around what you should disclose when you're speaking about a matter that's material to you. You know, and it actually the rules are so clear on this. If you haven't declared a contract, for example, on the rental accommodation scheme on your SIPO return, your standards and public office return, then you must say, if you're speaking on an issue related to that in the Dáil, you must say that in the Dáil.
Did I
see, of course, you're entitled to speak on it.
You're nodding.
But, you know, so sorry, Anton, these rules are very clear, you know, and that's the reality.
The SIPO rules are clear. I think he is hard done by insofar as he had nobody to proofread that statement for him. And I don't want to say the word tell him to cop on, but I think it was not, you know, a statement that reflected the seriousness of the situation, maybe. And also, you know, there were, along the way in the last few weeks, there were a number of issues that I, you know, had concerns around. I think asking a tenant in the current climate to sign an affidavit, any landlord asking, and you know, all tenants in Ireland are in a vulnerable situation now. Any tenant being asked to sign an affidavit by the person who is putting a roof over their head, I think is a misstep to put that into the public domain. And I don't think you should have done it to begin with.
I don't want to overlay with the Robert Troy thing, but Gerard, I do want your view on that thing that Ness is raising about the nature of the statement. Usually you have a choice. You can come out swinging or you can fall on your sword. He decided to fall on his sword while swinging.
Yeah. Now, just very briefly, why are there more landlords per the population generally? It's the same reason traditionally there were more farmers, more teachers. The slog of getting elected in a multi-seat constituency, it's so intense that unless you can organise your business to have more free time than the average, you're never going to get elected anything. That's why we have more than average landlords in the country. And also people, you know, from the noughties, there's a legacy of a lot of credit and people getting credit and having little mini urban estates and all the rest. But as Ivana said, it doesn't ring well in a current climate where so many people can't get any property. In relation to Robert Troy swinging and falling simultaneously, I was highly amused by the umbrage in the media, who are great, myself included, by the way, of giving out umbrage. But if you give out umbrage, you should be calm enough to listen to some criticism sometime. And maybe some of the umbrage in the media needs to be challenged about in relation to what he said. Because if he has a view, and he's entitled to it, he's entitled to say it. And there was a media view that somehow he had crossed a line. Well, no, you don't cross a line. If you criticise the media, you're entitled, and if that is what you want to do.
And just to say, I think, you know, certainly there were some things he said had happened that were inexcusable by media in terms of people camping out at relatives' houses and so on. And that's certainly, I don't think anyone could endorse
and
that.
And I think he was raising that there was significant inaccuracies in some of the reporters around.
But sorry,
all of which say, I think some people wouldn't like take a swig or two out of a bottle of their own tonic.
But surely the problem here is that letter should have been a full stop. That should have put a bookend to the story until the SIPO investigation and the Oireachtas investigation happens. And instead, it has given birth to a whole new story. And I'm not sure that was the process that anybody had in mind. And that's why you go to your staff or you go to a trusted advisor and you say, is this the statement I should put out?
On more important, to quote that great David Handy line about buttering of parsnips, the things that butter people parsnips isn't Robert Troy's career. It is at the moment the issues to do with making ends meet as we come into the autumn, and obviously the questions around what the budget can and will do for people and the hikes. We see today, Nessa Harrigan, the increase in bin charges getting added to the list of everything else that is going up.
Yeah, and it's really worrying, and I think that this budget will be almost solely about the cost of living. Certainly we have, you know, had good tax receipts this year. And so what I would like to see is a kind of a two-pronged approach, which is a real kind of engagement with the idea of indexation and, you know, gender proofing and diversity proofing and disability proofing the budget. So, you know, a real look at how our welfare system is working, a real look at how our services are working, but also targeted measures for this year. So, for example, you know, know, I want targeted measures, except when it comes to child benefit. Like we have seen child benefit in real terms fall over the last decade. That would be a measure that we would really like to see increased.
And what are the targeted measures you want?
Well, for example, energy costs. The leader of our party, Eamon, has argued yesterday for a windfall tax on the excessive profits that energy companies are making at the moment, and that could be directly funded into targeted measures. Whether that's, you know, an actual check that people get into their hand, or that's something with working for companies. I know the CRU announced a number of measures yesterday, which are very welcome: a moratorium on cutting people off, and also things like putting people on that pay-as-you-go meter on the cheapest possible tariff immediately. I think they are all great measures, but they're not going to solve that.
It's going to be an interesting issue for the Green Party in Ireland, but for Green Party across Europe in the energy crisis.
Absolutely.
Because if you look at Germany now, talking about restarting coal-fired generation, restarting nuclear plants, the same questions will start to be asked about Ireland, about whether or not we go back to dirtier means of production if we get stuck. Difficult from your perspective.
It's incredibly difficult, and it's also a very, you know, a real-time experiment in terms of, like, does pricing affect usage? And of course it does, we know, but how far can you push that? And it's got nothing to do with the green agenda, obviously, the price hikes at the moment. But I do think it's an incredibly challenging place to be. And ultimately, you know, we're not going to bring anyone with us by, you know, putting them into fuel poverty, by making them sit in cold houses, or you know, not them not being able to meet their food bill. So I don't think anybody is putting the green agenda above people's actual lived experience right now. That'll be the real challenge in Budget 2023.
To those two things, fuel poverty and people not being able to make their fuel bills, we saw during the week the Society for the Vincent de Paul suggesting that they are expecting, as they come into winter, this to be a record year for people seeking their services, Amanda.
Yes, and we're all hearing this. I mean, this is a time when people are facing extraordinary hardship and anticipating a really, really difficult winter. You know, I spoke recently with the Capuchin Trust about the greatly increased numbers who are seeking free meals from their service. People who would never have seen themselves in that position before. People who are themselves in employment, but who simply can't make ends meet. Those delivering food to others, for example, bike couriers who have to queue for free food from a charitable organisation because the money they're making is not enough to pay their rent, their fuel bills, and then to buy food. So this is a really serious situation we're in. Clearly NASA's party and the other government parties are going to have to step up with very significant targeted measures in the budget, which, as we know, is just in a few weeks' time. We in Labour have put forward a series of particular targeted measures that we need to see introduced as a matter of urgency to address the really increased costs so many people are facing. As I say, people whose incomes until now were sufficient to meet childcare costs, to meet fuel and food costs, and who are just finding that there's now a gap between what they're earning and what they're having to spend.
And of course, one of the big risks is that the gap between rich and poor increases, because at the same time, the economic numbers that are emerging in relation to economic growth and GDP are very positive. So there will be those to whom this will not be a big thing, and there will be those to whom this is crippling.
Yes, and indeed the COVID pandemic exposed that dual nature of our economy, where we have one sector which is doing very well, particularly multinational, and that's very welcome, of course, but there is also a whole cohort of people which are growing whose incomes are no longer enough to meet the cost of living, who cannot afford their decent housing, food, childcare. Huge issue. We really need to see a big plan put forward in the budget to address the crippling cost of childcare for so many families.
We are almost out of time. We have about a minute and 15 seconds left, and Jared, given that you were critical of the media earlier on, I'll hand this task to you. Can you give us the full analysis of the 6 months of the war in Ukraine to this point and your prediction of what will happen over the coming months?
What was to be a quick strike, a knockout Ukraine, is going on and on. 6 months later, there's absolutely no end in sight. There is no process to end it in sight. There is no decent, believable analysis out there as of now as to how it will end. We have to assume it will go on for several months more, and that instability that is driving these factors of people who are delivering food but can't afford to eat themselves, these things are completely connected.
Yes.
There is no end in sight.
Although to the one positive of that, it is possibly a better position for Ukraine than they might have hoped to be in when they were invaded 6 months ago.
Nobody, and perhaps themselves to an extent, believed they would still be an independent entity 6 months later.
And can we just all, I think, express our solidarity with the people of Ukraine, and particularly with those
Absolutely.
Who are here from Ukraine. I was proud to speak at the Ukrainian embassy on Wednesday night to mark their Independence Day and 6 months of this brutal Russian invasion, and they're certainly such a strong and resilient people, and I think all of us are thinking of them at this time.
On that note of consensus, Ivana Bacic, Labour Party leader, Nessa Hurricane, Green TD for Dublin Central, and of course this party spokesperson on finance and health, and Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Examiner columnist. Guys, thank you all very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.